This is for you visitors. This is the last section of the service, so you can. And this won't be long, I promise. But the way we kind of do things here with it, everyone or a lot of people sort of contributing is it's a little bit of an ethos here that. We really believe everyone has something to contribute in some way, and we all learn from each other. And none of us is an island. If we're not in community, then it doesn't matter how brilliant you may think you are, how well connected to God, and how much inspiration. If you're not bumping shoulders with other people, it's just you will shrivel up, right? And it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine, from a parent of a classmate of my son's, and he's Jewish. And we were talking about both of our work situation and congregation and the synagogue that he goes to. He stopped going to one synagogue and now goes to another, and he was saying, but you know what, it doesn't even really matter which synagogue you go to. At the end of the day, like, what's important is that you're going and that you're a part of a community, and it's important that you are part of a place with people where you know you have these things in common, and there are people there that you would otherwise have nothing to do with. These are people who you don't like, but you meet because you're in community together. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. You know, you usually sort of think, well, yeah, we come to community and we all have differences, and the point is to sort of meld and mesh and reconcile. And that's true. I believe that. But he was making the point that, you know, he's like, there's people at synagogue who I will probably never like, but it's important for me to be there and be in community with those people, and that we're supportive of each other in the ways that we are meant to as a community. And I thought, wow, that puts a new light on community and how we benefit and how God ultimately speaks to us and shapes us. So I was reading the parasha and this week, and it's, as you heard, it's like rated R, or at least PG-13. Right. This is one of the sections that, if you're teaching the youth, that you like, you probably just choose to skip over, because, I mean, that'll give your kids nightmares. This story. But I really struggled, and I kept struggling with it. And I thought, you know what? I'm gonna struggle through this thing and squeeze something out of it. So this is what. I got out of it. It's as we heard, and this is great. Thanks for everything you shared. None of those insights occurred to me. So that was. I'm glad that you did. But basically, it's the story about Korach, as we heard, and how some of his friends get together and come to Moses to complain about his leadership, right? Okay, that's a bit of an understatement. And so then this can be the first sort of takeaway from this passage, right? How we choose to describe an event, an argument, or a person, place, or thing will always be biased and prejudiced by our perspective. It's simply impossible to be completely neutral or objective on an issue. I think most people recognize that these days, but there are those who will therefore dive headstrong into the most impassioned, persuasive version of a story in an effort to convince you of their truth. And there are others who believe that despite the fact that it may be impossible to ever fully know the objective truth, we still have to try. That the effort is worth it, even if we end up with what is still incomplete, murky, and somewhat obscured. I'll take a well-studied but an admittedly incomplete view of the world over a confident and unabashedly partial or biased version of events any day. Okay, that doesn't sound very uplifting, does it? Murky, obscure, incomplete. But that's exactly how we're called to live. Here's my proof text. For now we know in part, and we prophesy in part. When that which is perfect has come, then that which was in part will be done away with. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. Okay, back to Korach and Moses. That's from 1 Corinthians 13:9-13. So back to Korach and Moses. I said that Moses showed up with a few of his friends to complain to Moses. Here's what it actually says in our passage in Number 16. They rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" So 250 men came with Korach. No one shows up to a meeting with that many people unless they mean to make a very big impression. Right? That impression, theoretically, can be positive, like if you wanted to express their gratitude in a grand way or even to evince submission. But this show of force was clearly meant to express something else, something more menacing. "You take too much upon yourselves," they say to Moses and Aaron. The Hebrew just says, "much for you," rav lechem. But what is it that's too much for them? How exactly do they exalt themselves above the rest? To me, this criticism sounds a little vague. You would think Moses would have some clarifying questions for them, to ask them what they mean by that. But no, Moses understands the implication of this gesture immediately. He doesn't just try to decipher what they're saying. He's heard their words in context. And the context is one of 250 men, all men of renown, leaders of their community, who could potentially be rivals or even alternatives to Moses and Aaron. So what does Moses do? It says, so when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. And he spoke to Korach and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show you who is his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him. That one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him." Then Moses suggests, as we heard, that they all conduct a test that will demonstrate exactly which position each person is meant to be serving in. Korach and his men were Levites, after all, and Moses asked them if they thought it was a small thing that God had assigned them to that calling. Moses then invites Dotan and Aviram, two other leaders Korach had brought with them, to try to reason with them, but it says they refuse to come up. They say, "Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of the land of flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you should keep acting like a prince over us? Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. Okay. So now their original intent becomes a little clearer. They're not just a little concerned Moses has taken on too big a workload and that he's become a little too haughty and proud. They believe he's completely inept as a leader and that his leadership is endangering the lives of the entire nation. They believe his single largest policy coup, rescuing the Israelites from slavery and bringing them to the promised land, is actually an abject failure. Instead of promised land, all they see is wilderness, where they believe chances are they won't survive. And in hindsight, Egypt was a land of milk and honey compared to this. So in response to this, Moses is infuriated and asks God not to respect their offerings to him. "I have not taken one donkey from them, nor have I hurt one of them," he complains to God. And so God begins to unleash his wrath, as he said, climaxing in the most notorious passage from this story when, and it says, "It came to pass, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground split apart under them and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the men with Korach, with all their goods. So they and all those with them went down alive into the pit, Sheol. The earth closed over them and they perished from among the assembly. Then all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, 'Lest the earth shall swallow us up also.' And a fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense." After that, the Israelites protest to Moses and Aaron that they have killed the people of the Lord. In response to that, there's a plague that kills several thousand more. The dying finally relents when Moses intercedes and stands, physically placing his body in between the living and the dead, thereby making atonement for the people. It's hard not to sympathize with the people here by this point. Of course, in hindsight, we know that the Israelites were indeed led into the promised land and that the incredibly arduous sojourn through the wilderness wasn't a death trap, that God would sustain them through it. But at first glance, this looks as though Moses just can't handle criticism. So what if the people don't have everything right? Aren't some of their complaints legitimate? Was this the only way to deal with Korach's campaign against Moses, even if it was illegitimate? Was this really an insurrection on the part of all the people, and was it necessary for them all to die? Obviously, these are questions that have been asked many times before in one way or another. And as I said, we don't know everything, but there are all kinds of hypotheticals we can suggest. Maybe Moses was indeed facing a rebellion that was on the brink of forming a coup. Maybe there wasn't just mistrust and disagreement over leadership styles, but perhaps Korach and his men were downright evil and would have destroyed every good thing Moses and Aaron built. Maybe they would have led the people of Israel right back into slavery into Egypt. In the same way Moses was trying to read what Korach was saying to him in context of who was standing next to him and under what circumstances, so we have an obligation when reading a story like this in the Bible to read it in context. There are several contexts we have to consider, but I just want to highlight a couple to show how much it affects our understanding of passages like this. One context to think about is who the original target audience of this particular section of the Bible was. The people who first read this story were of a certain time and culture. Their value system, their moral code and beliefs would have been vastly different from ours. So, for example, they wouldn't judge Moses or Korach in the same way that we do. Maybe they would have seen things more harshly, or maybe more mercifully. Certainly, they would have asked very different questions. Here's an example of what I mean. Oftentimes, you hear criticism of the brutal harshness of the law in the Hebrew Bible. For example, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth would lead to a world of the blind and toothless. The famous maxim people like to quote, criticizing that biblical statute. But if you know that in the Near East, the legal codes of antiquity usually prescribed different punishments for the loss of an eye, depending on the status of both the perpetrator and the status of the victim, then you realize that the biblical law came about in a context of profound social inequality before the law. Right? So the laws in Mesopotamia, if a master knocked out the eye of someone else's slave, he paid that slave owner, not that slave, the slave, forget the slave, he doesn't get anything. But the slave owner, because he's damaged that guy's property and he's now damaged goods, you would pay him a fine, a monetary fine, because his slave, like a workhorse, you know, is limping, and you know, like in a car accident, you've caused some damage, you pay a fine. If a slave knocked out the eye of a master, someone, you know, a general citizen, there's no fine, there's no anything that can be paid. That slave dies. He dies for an eye, not a murder, just knocking out an eye. And then if two people of the same status knocked each other's eye out, whatever, there are all kinds of different rules. The point is, completely different rules depending on who you were, who the other person was. The Bible comes, right, by establishing the principle that the eye, tooth, and essentially life of one person was as valuable as the next, no matter what his or her social status. The Bible was making a radical counter-cultural claim that all humans are equal in the eyes of God. This was crazy talk to say such a thing. An eye for an eye. What? Doesn't matter who did it and who did it. You know, an eye for an eye. A life for a life. A human life. I don't care who you are. You are made in God's image. So viewed from our context, the biblical law seems harsh. But seen in the context of its day, you can see how it's suddenly cast in a whole new light. It may still seem somewhat harsh by modern standards, and yet certainly we can no longer judge the biblical law as rigidly as we thought we could from our very narrow, historically limited experience of Western culture. But still, we have to contend with the stories we have, and even in context, they can be challenging. Take, for example, the chapter right before ours in Numbers 15. There's a passage that says this. Now while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. Everyone remember where this is going? And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. They put him under guard because it had not been explained what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, "The man must surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp." So as the Lord commanded Moses, all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. That's not bedtime reading. Now, even this story has a context, and many things could be said that might mitigate some fears or might cause some new ones. But lucky for us, we have Jesus, so I'm going to go straight to him. But before I do, of course, I have to say that Jesus also needs to be read in context. Okay, and if you have been coming to Narkees for any amount of time, you know that context is the Second Temple Jewish life, culture, and religious practice. That was, of course, very different from our own, but also quite different from modern or even medieval Judaism, and different again from the Israelite faith of King David. A quick example of how better understanding of this context helps us understand what Jesus was saying is Matthew 16:19. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Right? This is a very common verse that it's been talked about up here, and but if you haven't heard it, you know, you oftentimes it's used in context of in charismatic circles binding spirits, it's interpreted all kinds of ways. But we know from rabbinic literature reflecting language at the time, that those terms we have translated as bind and loose would have likely been something quite different in the Hebrew that Jesus was speaking. Instead of bind and loosed, the terms he probably used were to forbid and permit. Jesus was telling his disciples that when he left the earth, the responsibility would fall on them to interpret the law of the Bible, to know what to forbid and what to permit. So Jesus himself oftentimes seemed to take an extremely strict position on keeping the law, more stringent even than our story about the man gathering sticks on the Sabbath. Jesus said, not only should you not commit adultery, for example, but I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye, here comes some plucking, causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members should perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. It's pretty harsh. But then what did Jesus say to do when they actually caught someone? Not looking lustfully, actually caught in the act of adultery. Like Moses, she was brought to Jesus, and here too, everyone knew the law. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say? And they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. That they meant it merely as a test seems to indicate that they knew there was no way he would prescribe that she be stoned. They also seem to have known that there was no way that Jesus would have categorically dismissed the law. They really seem to have believed that they had him caught in a dilemma here. But again, like Moses, Jesus seemed to have a good read of the people he was engaged with. And it wasn't that he always chose confrontation either. There were times when he stayed silent, times when he fled the scene altogether. This time, he knew they could be challenged, even though there's a life and death situation here. We know how this episode ended with one of the most famous lines in history. And I know it in the King James because it's one of those lines that you memorize, right? Even though I never even grew up reading the King James. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone, right? What's going on here? Jesus seemed to have absolutely impossibly lofty standards. Pluck your eye out if it causes you to sin. Sell all you have and give it to the poor. Anyone who says fool is in danger of hellfire. Yet faced with a concrete case like the adulteress, and he bends all the way towards grace. Bends without breaking. Jesus was confronted directly over the Sabbath issue as well. And each time, whether it was explaining the legitimacy of healing of a healing he conducted on that day, or his disciples picking grain on Shabbat, he argued for leniency. Leniency, not abolishment. He never said none of this is irrelevant, or none of this is relevant anymore, that we can do what we want on the Sabbath. Again, Jesus argued within a certain context, giving reasons and examples from the Bible for how his particularly lenient practice could be justified and interpreted in the way that he did. So I want to end with this, that one of the greatest contributions of the Protestant Reformation was this notion that we could throw off centuries of atrophied traditions and return directly to the source text to reveal original content and intent, which was fantastic. I mean, it was revolutionary. But this notion was also a bit of a handicap in some ways, because we often threw the baby out with the bathwater when we rid ourselves of a lot of rich heritage in many cases. And it's a handicap notion because you can't fully recover the source at the end of the day. Like archaeologists, we can get relics and glimpses of the past, but never fully retrieve it. All of this has been on my mind these past weeks, as many of us parents have been attending the parenting boot camp you've heard about several times mentioned up here. And the more we talk about our parenting skills, the more I want to pluck out my eye or chop off my arm when I think about how I'm not even close to the standard, and frankly, I might be in risk of hellfire. But then I'm encouraged by Jesus' encounter with the adulteress. We need to be in community with a tradition and customs for handling wayward parents, like myself. Like all of us, I think that's been one of the most kind of revealing things about this thing, is that just kind of not parenting on your own and hearing other people's trials and failures is comforting. And and you need that. We need to have a mirror held up to one another so we can see that murky reflection. A murky reflection to some degree for all of us, even if not to the same degree. Some of us are worse than others. I'm one of the worst ones, so I can say that. We all have different struggles and weaknesses. And then we need to hear those words of Jesus. Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you? She said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said to her, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more.